listening to the Massage Therapist Development Initiative. I'm Jamie Johnston.
And I am Eric Purvis. This is a podcast by massage therapists for massage therapists.
Our objective is to simplify how to be a more evidence-informed practitioner. Let's dig into this episode. Okay, we're back another time for an episode of the Massage Therapist Development Initiative. And as we have talked about in past podcasts, where we talk about your modality doesn't really matter, we're actually going to jump into some research on one of the modalities that's out there. And funny enough, it's a modality that I fell hook, line, and sinker for early in my career, because I wanted to save my hands, but I also wanted to be different, because not many therapists were using instrument-assisted soft tissue mobilization. So I paid a whole bunch of money, went and took this course, and then I paid $3,000 for tools to try to stand out and be different, but came to realize later that it wasn't doing all the things that they told me it was doing.
Yeah, and I personally have never done the tool thing. Mm-hmm. I never took that plunge. I do, though, remember early in my practice using some of the reflex hammers and stuff that the chiropractor that I worked with had, and doing those things to kind of do some like scraping or some like what I was at the time assuming I was doing, kind of like some like, you know, deeper type tissue things I didn't want to save my hands on. And it's funny is I do have these very vivid memories of that, of creating like really, or helping these people a lot and creating really profound effects. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, oh, this is great. But I remember looking at the courses like Graston and IASTM courses, and they're so expensive.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, well, I can use reflex hammer. I got one right here.
Yeah.
So I don't need to spend that money.
Yeah. And yeah, like I say, I think the course was $500 or $600 that I took, and then another $3,000 for the tools. And now the tools are, for the most part, sitting and collecting dust.
Yeah. They're pretty little office decorators.
Yeah. 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 Which is funny because, you know, we've talked lots about patient preference, and I have some people who absolutely love them and come in and they're like, yeah, use that on me, which is great because they get an effect out of it because they enjoy it. But it's just not something that I try to introduce to new patients a whole lot anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. I think when we've had these conversations before, when we look at, you know, we challenge kind of some of the general ideas or narratives about the modalities, I think it can come across often as like we're saying that, you know, it's all garbage, but really what we need to really hammer home again and again and again is that if you like using tools,
use them.
There's no problem with using tools. The problem that oftentimes has to do, I think, with the clinical reasoning behind the tools. Why are you using the tool?
Yeah.
What information are you giving to the person in front of you? Why are they in? What are they hoping to gain from the treatment? And what are they taking from the tool? Are they thinking that when you're using the tool that you're breaking down scar tissue, that you're releasing adhesions, that you're, you know, disengaging or getting rid of like myofascial trigger points? Is that what they're thinking? And the only way that they can manage is for you to do this tool technique.
Yeah.
Then we say, okay, that is not an evidence-based
explanation.
Yeah. But if you're using the tools just as a way to maybe address different, like treat an area that might be, maybe you want to save your thumbs or your fingers and you want to try something different. Or maybe the person has had a really positive experience with having a tool, instrument-assisted treatment, and it's worked for them in the past, and you're like, well, actually, I do have these, I can do this as well. But I think as long as the understanding is supported by science, then I don't think either of us see a problem with that.
No. Yeah. But that brings us to one of the issues with this.
Yes.
Is that when I took the course, a lot of what they were teaching was that, oh, you're going to do this and you're going to see the skin get red, and you have to talk to your patient because you might leave a little bit of bruising after, because what you're doing is you're going in there and scraping the area and you're increasing inflammation in order to get more healing properties to that area. And that's how we're fixing the issue that they have, which we now know is wildly inappropriate as far as an explanation goes. So that goes back to what you were saying, that, you know, we have to give an accurate narrative about what's happening with any modality that we use.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Now, is this episode here, is this broadcast on YouTube? Are we going to put it on YouTube?
We can.
Okay. Let me see the background here. Jamie and I are in Jamie's condo today.
Yeah. So we're looking at each other a lot rather than...
a lot as we're doing this. People are listening to the podcast, we're like, I don't care if the people on YouTube are. We haven't done an in-person one of these
in a while.
And probably since early days
because of
COVID stuff and even now.
Schedules and...
Yeah, and schedules. Yeah. Even now, we're supposed to be mindful of our connections with people, but hopefully we're both safe.
So I think basically both of us looked at a whole bunch of the research around this, and we should give a shout out to our buddy Taylor Laviolette, who shared a bunch of research with us because he's done some presentations on this in the past and shared a bunch of research with us that we could look at. So I think probably a good place to start is to go back to what I was just talking about, that we look at the narratives behind it or what the proposed mechanisms were. And one of the big ones was that you're bringing inflammation into the area. But some other ones that the research has shown that weren't presented to me when I took the course is that using this, you'd be causing greater flexibility compared to just doing manual therapy without the tools. Because with the tools, you're reaching deeper tissues to have a more significant effect. And some other proposed changes would be joint range of motion and increased stretch tolerance, and also decreasing muscle stiffness by inhibiting muscle activity by modulating the nervous system.
Okay, so they're starting to put some nervous system lingo into this, which a lot of things are now.
Yeah.
To try and make it sound more science-y, more evidence-based. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. But part of the flaws, of course, is like the more that I looked at the research other than some of the systematic reviews, is that a lot of the research was being done by people who were trying to prove that it worked.
Yeah, so that's the problem with a lot of this research. And I must say thanks as well to TJ for kind of collating a bunch of this stuff, because I had seen some of the IASTM and Graston, or some of the research calls it ASTM.
Yeah.
I think
there's assisted soft tissue, or
I think it's assisted. Yeah. So it's basically using a tool. I think I was really happy to him to share his review of this. And I think it was a pretty fair review, because there was a bunch of the stuff in here that was, systematic reviews. Mm-hmm. There was stuff in here that was very negative towards Graston and tools. And there's stuff in there that was favorable towards it.
Yeah.
And I think it provided a kind of both sides. But then, when we look at it, though, you have to be critical.
Yep.
About being critical of the research and what is the research really saying? And is this, what is this paper that's been published? Is this saying what it's supposed to be saying?
Yeah.
And I think, so this stuff that we're going to talk about, I feel, does a good job of kind of providing a non-biased way of looking at it.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's more realistic.
Yeah. One of the things that I actually liked, and I'm sure we're going to jump around a little bit here, but one of the things that I liked is when they looked at a lot of the research, especially in the systematic reviews, was they basically said it's only a very effective modality if you're including movement, exercise, and stretching with it.
Right.
And when they looked at, I believe it's Graston that actually lays out what a treatment should look like. And the treatment should look like assessment, some warm up, some treatment with the tools, and then some movement and stretching to go with it. Okay. And if we actually looked at any modality, if that's what every single modality taught, we'd probably have a lot greater success.
Yeah, because it's actually an entire treatment process rather than just a specific technique.
Yeah. Yeah. Whereas a lot of the research that's trying to prove it never talked about any of that. They just talked about when we used a tool, this is what we propose will happen. But if we were to look at any interaction with a patient and said, we're going to start with an assessment, we're going to warm up the tissue a little bit, and then we're going to use whatever modality, and then afterwards, we're going to do some exercise and some stretching to go with it.
Yeah.
We'd have greater success with every modality.
Yeah. And that goes back to, I can't remember which episode it was, when we talked about the mechanisms of massage therapy or manual therapy.
Yeah.
And really, if you can come to an agreement that every different way of manipulating, touching, mobilizing somebody is working on the same or very similar mechanisms.
Yes.
Then you realize that it's, that that is what is happening. These are all different ways of kind of hacking the system, so to speak. And then, if you use whatever intervention you like, whatever intervention the patient likes, the person in front of you, trying to get away from the words patient, client,
The people we see.
The people we see, then you can, your use of that modality or intervention is a piece of the overall treatment. Too often, though, I think we both agree that there's an over-reliance on just that.
The tissue-based.
Tissue-based thing. And not looking at what you said, the exercise, the movement, the education, the reassurance, the home care. All that stuff is well, research suggests that stuff's more important than just the intervention, so to speak.
Which is great when you mention home care, because one of the papers that I read said they had greater success when the person had 3 sessions of home care per week.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
There you go.
So that would be applicable to any any modality that we do. So it's, I just find it interesting that they, a lot of the research or a lot of the proposed mechanisms didn't take into account these other things that are very important.
Question for you. When you did your Graston training, what did they teach? Like, what did you get out of that course? Like, what did they tell you to do?
It was a long time ago. But a lot of it was like, you know, you can use, because there's in that course, there's 5 or 6 different tools, and they're being, they would be like, with this tool, this is how you can mobilize the shoulder. With this one, this is really good for, like, they called it framing around like the patella.
Okay.
Because one looks like a butter knife and one looks like another thing and whatever else. So it was more, you know, they would talk about breaking down scar tissue a bit, because, you know, I got this big gnarly scar on my knee. And of course they're like, oh, we could like totally mobilize that scar tissue and have a greater effect with it using this tool. And there was the discussion about the inflammation and all that, but the majority of the course was like, this is how you use this specific tool. And this one is more appropriate for this area. This one's more appropriate for this area. And that's why there's this range of.
So you get different sets of tools for different body parts or different.
Yeah. Like one looks like the handlebars off of a mountain bike.
Oh, okay.
Which is actually really good for like digging in around the scapula and mobilizing the shoulder and getting it moving. Okay. Another one has like 2 hooks on it, which is good for like working around the thumb or working around the kneecap, and because it's got that curve that you can use. So yeah, they each kind of have their own little application. And they're actually like, I like using them.
Yeah.
But I just don't use the narrative. I don't use them a lot anymore, but don't use the narrative that they taught. It's just a different way to touch.
Right. It's interesting, hey, that the, and this is something that comes up a lot in the manual therapy world, is this desire to increase inflammation in tissue because that's what's required for it to heal and get better.
Yeah.
Which when we actually, if you actually take the time to kind of reflect on that and you think about inflammation, inflammation is a process which is used to repair tissue.
Yeah.
Your body will always repair tissue unless you've got some rare, you know, genetic or systemic disease.
Yeah.
But like 99.9% of people will be able to heal, you know, along a fairly predictable timeline, at least from the stuff that I've read. But it's so interesting how these narratives about creating inflammation are, is like, that's supposed to be a good thing.
Yeah.
But when, if you think about it, inflammation sensitizes nociceptors.
Mm-hmm.
It sensitizes the tissue. So what it ends up doing is it ends up making the area more sore.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're actually creating like a noxious input into a tissue, which doesn't need inflammation. And you oftentimes are making it more sore.
Yeah.
Now, some people might say, or they're listening, might say, but I use these things and people feel better. And the reason they feel better is because you're having like a counter irritation. The area is sore and you're providing a different stimulus,
mm-hmm.
which is probably more sore. You know, you're going to have that kind of like endogenous, you know, pain control, that opioid system is going to turn on and you're going to feel, it's going to numb you a little bit, so to speak.
Yeah.
That's how, as far as I understand the literature on that and the science on that. So I think it's, we have to be very careful of, you know, purposely trying to create inflammation because, you know, you could be very well intended, but you don't really want to create inflammation in already inflamed tissue or already sore tissue.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense. Yeah. Logically, when you understand the physiology, you think that doesn't make sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting too. Like, I remember a number of years ago, probably 6 or 7 years ago now, there was a big hate on for rice, you know, the rest, ice, compress, elevate, all that. And I mean, I understand the research has come a long way to show us that there's different ways to manage things. But I remember having a conversation with an athletic therapist buddy of mine, who's a really smart guy. And still to this day, I still think it's appropriate, you know, on an inflamed tissue, especially in, like, because I'm a first aid geek, but for a first aid setting, to put some ice on there, maybe take some ibuprofen to help out with it a little bit. And I remember having a conversation with him, and he's like, yeah, all these people are saying that. But he goes, in general, the body overdoes it with inflammation because it wants to send as much there. And he was like, if you really think taking a couple ibuprofen is going to stop enough inflammation that it's going to make that much of a difference, he's like, you're crazy. Yeah. And then, of course, a little bit of ice. He goes, but both of those things can be a bit of an analgesic. So since we already know that the body overdoes it with inflammation a little bit, why would we want to go in and create more of it?
And if I remember correctly, there is the new guidelines for acute injuries actually say avoid analgesic, or no, sorry, avoid anti-inflammatories.
Yes.
I believe, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I still
healing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't think it does, like, taking a couple ibuprofen isn't going to be enough to stop.
No.
And like enough inflammation that inflammation isn't going to get to that area.
Yeah, you're not going to stop your entire system from doing what needs to do.
Yeah. Yeah. But if it helps with the pain a little bit, take an ibuprofen.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
Yeah. 100%.
That's just my opinion on it.
I think it's a very evidence-informed or evidence-based opinion.
Yeah. So when I looked into some of the papers, there was one study that looked how IIS-Tamuda influenced some of the proposed mechanisms, and they were looking at how it worked on ankle dorsiflexion. So one of the great things is that there were improvements in dorsiflexion range of motion, but it found that there was no input from the central nervous system, that IIS-TM had lesser effect than static stretching, less effective in improving flexibility than static stretching, and it didn't change the stiffness of the muscle belly or stretch tolerance, and it didn't change the perception of pain due to the stretch tolerance.
Okay.
So a lot of the mechanisms that were being proposed were proven wrong in one of the studies.
Right.
So the more we look at these modalities and the explanations behind them, the more that we have to question it. And I found it interesting going through and reading those papers that there was no... Not that there is in a lot of the research, but there was no mention of contextual factors and the other things that go into the treatment other than just, I'm going to scrape this area with a tool.
Right. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff that is just looking at the specific effects of the tool on the thing. Did you look through any of the stuff that had to do with the animal studies?
The one on the rabbit Achilles tendon one.
There's a rabbit one, and
there was a rat one, I believe,
too. Rat one as well, which we looked at, which was interesting because... You know, traditionally, you know, when you start with doing animal research, and if you get stuff from there, then you can go to humans.
Yeah. But there hasn't been any done on human yet.
Not in this way, but it's interesting because looking at the specific, like what's happening from a histological perspective in the tissues, and looking at how things change, the animal ones were interesting for that. Now, I know from looking through these ones that we've looked at here, that a few of these studies, or many of these studies, are used in those people who are trying to support IIS-TM and Graston. But I would argue that those that are using the stuff to support that are not looking at, not reading the research with a skeptical eye, so to speak.
Yeah.
You know, like the rat one, for example, I've seen this one before. It's from 1997, so it's old. Right. And so you got to take that with a grain of salt. You're like, okay, this paper is 24
years old. Yeah.
And also too, it is a rat study. It's an animal study. And there is some other commentary and research on looking at, you know, you can never make this giant leap that what happens in a rat is the same thing that's going to happen in a human.
Yeah.
Because all you're looking at is the tissue, but that doesn't mean what you're doing doesn't mean you're impacting function or pain necessarily, because humans and rats are different. So This one here, though, is called, this one is called, this paper is called, what do you call it? Rat tendon morphological and functional changes resulting from soft tissue mobilization. So what they did this one is they had four groups. Two groups, they actually gave them surgery where they cut open their Achilles tendon, or cut open, did surgically incised around the Achilles tendon. They put some enzyme in there, which created an inflammatory response and created basically a tendinopathy in the rats. And then they sewed them up, and then they did, you know, ASTM is what they call it in this paper. And really what they found with this, though, which was interesting, was that those that had surgery had increased fibroblast activity, mm-hmm. right? So you had four groups. One group had nothing. Two groups had surgery. One group just had surgery. One group had surgery plus ASTM, and one group just had ASTM. And then guess what? The ones that had the surgery had increased fibroblast activity.
Because it's trying to repair the area.
Because it's trying to repair an area from the surgery, as well as the area was enzymatically irritated, basically created a tendinopathy. So I would say that it's a big leap to say, well, you know, a surgically induced, enzymatically induced tendinopathy is the same as one that's going to happen to somebody that's maybe after COVID is returning back to a sport and is like increasing their load and activity and maybe getting a little bit of tendon failure.
Yeah.
Not the same. I would think mm-hmm. that's a big leap to say those are the same. But what they did find, though, was the group that just had the ASTM alone did have some areas with increased fibroblasts, but not as many as the groups which had surgery. What this suggests to me, though, is that you're irritating the tissue. Yeah. You're irritating the tendon.
You're damaging it.
You're actually causing damage to it. Just trying to repair it.
Yeah.
Which I think is a problem, yeah. so to speak. And, but then you also have to kind of take a step back and say, well, is increased fibroblast activity, is that important or necessary for tendon recovery? We don't know. I would say you'd have to first establish if fibroblasts are important.
Yeah.
As part of that rehab process. And I don't know, but I would make this, I'm kind of making an assumption based on other things I've read that hasn't been established. So this research, all it says is that you're getting increased fibroblasts in tissue when you've done
irritated
surgery.
It. Yeah. Well, and the other thing is,
or irritated it. It doesn't have anything to do with outcome.
Yeah. And we also know that, you know, when we look at Jill Cook's research and things like that, when they look at tendons, one of their recommendations is do not massage the tendon.
Exactly.
When we're trying to get over a tendinopathy. So taking a tool and scraping that tendon with it isn't going to be helpful for it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a big thing, right? That's the current guidelines from everything we've read and things that we teach is that, yeah, don't piss off an already cranky tendon, right? You know, the load, right? That load progression, you know, heavy load progression preferably is the kind of the best evidence to recover from an Achilles or any type of lower limb tendon thing. And I know for myself, someone who's suffered Achilles tendon problems over the last 4 or 5 years, that following those evidence-based guidelines of, you know, isometric, isotonic, plyometric, return to sport guidelines, that might be another episode. Actually works really well.
Yeah.
Whereas before, when I was getting, I've had it scraped.
Yeah.
And I've had massage.
And unfortunately, I've done that to people in the past.
Flipping killed. And you know what? It didn't make me feel any better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. And I find it, I think it was, and I'm doing this from memory because I didn't make a note about it. But in that rabbit study, I believe most of the things that they looked at with the rabbits was after they were euthanized.
Yes.
To see the changes.
Yes. They euthanized the rabbits and then they basically did, they cut them open and looked at, and under a microscope, electron microscope, they looked at the morphological and kind of histological changes in the tendon and the tissue.
But I would like to know how much of a difference that is when there's absolutely no nervous system input anymore.
Yeah. That's a good question. Yeah. I would say it's probably very different.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you also can't ask the rat, how's the rat feeling?
Yeah. Yeah. Did that treatment feel good?
Yeah.
Do you feel better about going about your activities now?
There was some stuff in that paper too. They were doing like gait analysis, but I thought, well, doing gait analysis of a
tiny little leg,
a tiny little animal, little leg seemed to me a little bit weird the way they did it. And I don't have a paper in front of me right now, got some notes I made on it. And that was one of the ones that, you know, I think if I remember correctly, the tendon that was irritated, they favored.
Of course.
Which makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They probably limped on it a little bit.
Yeah.
Because it was irritated.
Yeah, because irritated.
So now that we've talked about the animal studies, there was also some studies that were done where they looked at how ISTM would affect on hamstring range of motion, but they compared it to a massage roller stick. Did you read that one?
I did, yeah.
Okay, so they both helped increase range of motion after a 3.5-minute treatment, but one was not better than the other. And I love one of the points that it made was when they looked at that, using a massage stick is probably better because it's a low-cost tool that you could give to the person for home care, where they could do a little bit of home care with it. And it's definitely going to be less of an irritation and less damage than what that handlebar looking stainless steel tool is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. There was actually a lot of interesting studies, the way they kind of looked at this. And some of them here, if we look at some of the bigger studies, like there was one on IASTM soft tissue mobilization. It was a systematic review and effect size analysis.
Mm-hmm.
This one's from 2019, so a very recent one. And this one, just to summarize, what we found basically were that doing something was better than
nothing. Doing nothing.
So, but when compared to other interventions, other different manual therapy interventions, this one might have, I can't remember if they used exercise in here as well.
Was it the spinal manipulation one?
No, that's a different study.
Okay.
But they said, when compared to other interventions, IASTM is no better or worse for range of motion or pain.
Mm-hmm.
So this goes back to what we were saying before, is that it could be an intervention you use,
yep,
but it's not the be all and end all. And when we look at, you know, a recent, so 2 years ago, a systematic review and effect size analysis, you're better to have something done than doing nothing at all.
Yeah.
But I would argue though, that if you're having something done and you're being provided a narrative or story about what it thinks it's doing,
yeah,
that could potentially really lead to more negative health outcomes or beliefs or harm.
Yeah, creating dependence and other things. Yeah,
determine harm. That's another conversation. Then doing something else.
Yeah. Yeah. But it was interesting. I looked at the one and we know that there's not a ton of evidence behind spinal manipulation, but they compared in one of the studies between spinal manipulation, ISTM, and placebo, and found there wasn't much difference in helping people with thoracic pain.
Yes. Yeah, that was a randomized controlled trial. And said, basically the between groups, whatever they received, it didn't make any difference to the outcome.
Yeah.
They all kind of recovered, or they're, but I can't remember what they used to measurement to decide what was the outcome.
I think it was
a pain scale or something.
Yeah,
Oswestry disability scale. Yeah. So this one, was kind of doing. They had something done to them, and their outcomes were the same.
Yeah.
So there we go. Yeah. Doesn't matter what you do.
Yeah.
Which I know sounds really defeatist to a lot of people.
But that's not her intent.
No.
And then of course the one that really stood out to me was that we, in order to use the tools effectively, they also need to be disinfected.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the studies was a systematic review, and it was like a recommendation of how to use these things in treatment. And I didn't make notes about it, but it was something to the effect of, you have to like appropriately disinfect the tool between patients, but then you also have to disinfect the patient. So you have to use some kind of a wipe on their skin before using them. And like, it was this whole drawn out process where they basically said, if you want to use these things, this is the disinfecting process that you can use.
Right.
And I looked at it and I went, that's going to be really time consuming. And I doubt anybody's going to do that. So, you know, when we're looking at patient safety, that's one of the big things that we have to take into account if we're going to use these tools, is to make sure that every single thing is disinfected, because there is a possibility that you could break the skin.
Yep.
Very much a possibility. I mean, I've never broken the skin on anybody using them, but you see how red the skin gets and you're pushing on it pretty good if you're digging in with these things. So that is a possibility. But then taking the time, I mean, you have to disinfect your table, you have to go wash your hands and all these other things. So now you're actually disinfecting the patient and wiping off their back and that, or whatever part of their body that you're treating, and then disinfecting the tools. And you've basically applied this whole bigger process to your treatment now that wasn't there before if you are just starting to use these. So I think that's a big thing that needs to be taken into account. Like, how much time are you leaving between patients to make sure that everything is disinfected appropriately, to make sure you're not passing something on to the next person who comes in?
I guess we look at, you know, with COVID stuff going on now too, and the increased disinfection and cleaning requirements that are essential, you know, and important, you know, this is just be one more thing. It'd be very difficult to do within that 15 minutes. One of the things that, an interesting study here, and there's two of these here, I think, that looked at the use of instrument-assisted soft tissue treatment on myofascial trigger points.
Okay.
And I think there's a couple here that were both published. Actually, a lot of the stuff was published in the Journal of Body Work and Movement Therapies, which is unfortunate because these are the kind of journals... It's also the International Journal of Therapeutic Massage.
Yeah, the IJTMB, Movement and Body Therapy.
You know, and I would just love it if the academic journals for that are supposed to help our profession would stop putting non-evidence-based stuff in them. And so if we look at, so this one here, there is one from 2005 on instrument-assisted soft tissue for myofascial trigger points. There's another one from 2014, which was the influence of instrument-assisted soft tissue release on myofascial trigger points. The first thing we need to say about this, and this is probably going to get some people upset, is that the whole concept of myofascial trigger points is not established in the scientific literature. Mm-hmm. I just did, for my blog, which should be out soon, I'm just finishing up, I did like a research review on everything I could read, everything I could find about trigger points, and it was like massive. There's so much stuff out there. And really what it comes down to is that nobody really knows what myofascial trigger points are.
Yeah.
There's a couple of different ideas, a couple of different hypotheses, but it's never, there's not like an accepted definition.
Nothing proven.
There's nothing proven. Yeah. There's nothing we can say that this is even, we really even know what these are. There's the diagnostic criteria for myofascial trigger points. There's like 19 different diagnostic criteria for them. I believe it's 19. It's close to 90. If it's not 19, it's close. It's lots. So there's not even agreement on how to diagnose them. The only criteria that people can come up with when we're talking about myofascial trigger points is there's sore spots in tissue when we poke at them. That's it, right? And when we look at the intra-rater reliability, so how, like from each practitioner, how well can each practitioner identify them? Mm-hmm. So if someone's lying on a table and you don't have a diagnosis, or they're sitting in front of you and you're not told what's going on with them, and you go and you palpate them, experts struggle.
Yeah.
Like there's very little agreement on what's a trigger point and what's not a trigger point. When you are, if you are well-trained, now this is coming off my memory, so I could be off a little bit, but I'm pretty confident in this, what I'm saying. If you're well-trained, meaning you've got a lot of experience in palpating soft tissue stuff, and you are given a diagnosis in terms of someone comes in with like, say a rotator cuff pain, or they've got low back pain or whatever, and then you were focusing on that area and you're getting patient feedback,
that spot is tender.
Then that is kind of more accurate.
Mm-hmm.
But it, even then, still is not great.
Mm-hmm.
The reliability of it. So what's that mean? Well, it means that the whole concept of myofascial trigger points is being something that is diagnosed by palpation.
Yes.
When experts struggle to agree on that, and the scientific community, you know, is struggling to come to a diagnostic criteria for it, then what it makes me think is that, well, trigger points are probably not a thing that people think they are, and they might not be as important as people think they are.
Yeah.
Because those big red Bibles that we read, that we had to read in the massage school, the Travel books were, I think they were published in 1983.
Yeah.
So you had 40 years to move that narrative forward and move that idea forward. And it's actually no better now than it was before.
Yeah.
Really. So any paper this goes back to my original point, any paper that talks about, you know, treating myofascial trigger points, I would be very, very skeptical of, because we do not know what myofascial trigger points are. And we look at systematic reviews, you look at big studies that are the look at trigger points, and you're skeptical or you're critical of them. We don't really know.
Well, and there's a really interesting side to that. When I look back and I remember taking the course, and everything that you just said is that myofascial trigger points are about, like, you go in and palpate, mm-hmm. you feel an area, your patient gives you feedback. If you're using a thing that looks like a handlebar and you're pushing on something, how are you going to feel it?
Yeah.
How are you going to feel that trigger point? That, I mean, we all know that we've, like, treated a shoulder or an area and felt a bit of a bump there. Mm-hmm. And the patient says, yeah, that's
yeah.
tender. And I remember when we were taking the course, they're like, you can feel vibrations through the tool, but that could be as simple as, like, a pimple or something on the skin.
Right.
That's also going to send that. So, To have a paper that says you can effectively treat something mm-hmm. or treat a trigger point with this tool, but yet they're also saying that palpation is the way that you feel it, or the way that you can tell a trigger point is there. How can they confidently say, yes, you can treat trigger points with this tool?
Right.
When you can't actually feel where said trigger point is.
Yeah. It's very difficult to find them according, you know, and I think we could all, you know, there's our service, we've touched people, like, you feel things, and you feel lumps and bumps and sore spots or things, and you can, you know, you get that kind of, you know, I hate to use the word intuition, but you get that intuition or that skill of being able to, when you're putting your hands on people, getting that sensation of, like, oh, that's sore, like, they're experiencing discomfort there.
Yeah.
You can kind of, you know, read their body language, or you feel something, it feels, oh, that feels different from the other stuff.
Yeah.
And often, if you get that feedback from the person, oh, yeah, that's a sore spot. Okay. Is that a trigger point, though? Because if we don't know what trigger point is, or can we just say
it's a sore spot?
It's a sore spot. And I think that, to me, that makes more sense. Like, this is a sore spot. Let's not, we don't have to give it these names.
Yeah.
Because I think it's not evidence-based, and we have to think that, you know, if we're trying to find a very specific mechanistic descriptor of why someone hurts and it's a problem in the tissue, then we're missing the bigger picture.
Yeah.
Right. And then when we look at treatments of trigger points, you know, the injections and manual therapy, like ischemic compressions. We look at that stuff, and you look at the big reviews on that. They are no, doing that is no better than doing something else.
Yeah.
So you don't need to do that.
Yeah.
And if we look at what's the less wrong narrative about a trigger point, like, if we look at some of the hypotheses out there, kind of one of the ones which, you know, I think makes the most sense is if it's an irritated or inflamed kind of cutaneous nerve. Why is it inflamed? We don't know. I think we talked about this with Paul Ingraham a few episodes ago.
Yeah.
You know, like, we don't really know what causes that. But if there is an inflamed nerve, does it make sense to go and push or squish or grind on it with a...
And irritate it more.
And irritate it more. Do we know that irritated nerves are sensitive? Irritated more, guess what? It's probably going to become more and more sensitive. Yeah.
So go and irritate it and cause more inflammation around it.
Yeah, it just doesn't make sense. So when we look at these two studies, I think there's a long, sorry about that. We look at these studies looking at myofascial trigger points. You have to make the assumption trigger points are a thing.
Yeah.
They're not really a thing in terms of how we think they're. And then if we look at the terms like myofascial trigger points, that assumes that a trigger point is some problem within the myofascial tissue. And there's, if we look at the fascial research, this again might upset some people, but if you look at the fascial research, you can't actually change fascia with your hands anyway. Yep. You don't need to change it for people to feel better. So there's because of that causal relationship between fascia and pain has never been established. Mm-hmm. So why are you looking to do a treatment to change myofascial trigger points, and both of those things are not well established.
Yeah.
The causal relationship isn't established. So you look at research, what's it say? It says you do a tool on you, right? It doesn't work any better than anything
your
else.
Hands or...
Yeah. But when you look at this research, patients who got Graston or instrument assisted and followed an exercise schedule at home,
they got better.
So my like little 10-minute rant there says, do something to the person.
Get them to move.
That they like, that hopefully feels good, that doesn't inflame the tissue more.
Yeah.
Be mindful of the narratives or ideas or thoughts or beliefs that can be attributed to that treatment. And the key is getting them to do something.
Yeah.
Afterwards.
Yeah. And that's a matter of also having them engaged in the treatment and engaged in their own feeling of getting better. And interesting, like, I don't know if I'm going to say this right, because I've read it a couple of times, but I don't know if the pronunciation is right, but the palpatory pareidolia.
I think that sounds right.
Okay. Where it's basically like you believe you're palpating something.
Right. Pareidolia.
Pareidolia? Okay. We'll have to enter it into like some Google thing that tells us.
Have you seen Ted Lasso?
A couple of episodes, yeah.
And there's one episode where he's trying to, I can't remember what the word is, he's trying to say, he keeps saying it again and again and again. It doesn't sound right. So I feel like that's happening right now.
Yeah. But they obviously refrain from mentioning that in any of these studies as well, that you're going in with these tools, believing that you're going to find a trigger point, and then treating said trigger point plays into that palpatory pareidolia.
Yeah. Yeah, if you are told that you're going to feel something and you're expecting to feel something,
you're probably going to feel something.
You're more likely to feel something. Yeah, and there's actually some really cool research, which of course I can't quote off the top of my head because I don't have in front of me. But there's some research I've looked at for other stuff that suggests that's what happens.
Yeah,
you tell something, you're priming them to feel something
for a belief.
Yeah, for belief.
Yeah. Yeah. So I mean, interesting stuff, and I mean, thankfully looking into this, but. I think it always comes down to the same thing, is that all of the research about ISTM, none of it was like the good research or the research that showed a positive outcome. Mm-hmm. ISTM was never done as a standalone thing. It was always combined with other things to have a positive outcome. So, and I think we could say that of any modality.
Yeah.
You're going to have a better outcome if we follow those clinical guidelines
yeah.
of reassurance, education, movement, and some kind of treatment. If we just stick to that, it doesn't matter if you're using myofascial release, a tool, gua sha,
right.
whatever, you're probably going to have a better outcome.
Yeah. And that kind of makes sense, right? You're doing something.
Yeah.
First time something to end to them. When we look at IASTM, it is popular.
Yeah.
People love to take that stuff. And I would love... Like, I'm not against, I don't think either of us are against
using it,
people using that stuff. But what I would love to see, and I would say I have not seen this,
yeah.
is people that have taken those courses or the instructors that teach those courses. I have not seen people coming out of those courses with a proper understanding of what those tools actually do.
Yeah.
They are looking at inflammation, increasing inflammation in the speed of healing. They're looking at breaking down scar tissue. They're looking at disengaging trigger points. They're looking at
breaking down adhesions.
Yeah, providing some type of mechanistic
explanation
or understanding what's happening. And I think that I see that as being a problem.
Yeah.
I see that as being a big problem, because it seems to me that it's not pushing our profession forward. It's holding us back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's not even just massage therapy, because there's a ton of physios and chiros that take those courses as well and teach those courses.
Yeah.
So it's not helping their professions either.
We can do a whole episode, maybe another time, on dry needling.
Sure.
Which RMTs in BC can't do, but RMTs in other provinces can. In other parts of the world, I'm sure they can do it. We can look at their research on dry needling and realize that it's actually not good either.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's another one of those, in my opinion, without reading the research, it's that counter irritant thing.
Yeah.
Where you're going in and causing a bit more pain, and the brain goes, oh, that pain's gone away. So
And when we look at, and this is the problem with this stuff, though, is that people, practitioners, so the public, take a step back. The public wants to feel that they are going to be fixed, because they have this idea that their body is like a car,
mm-hmm.
or it's like a washing machine, and a part breaks and you get a new part and it works. Problem is that that's not how the body works. We know it's a complex biological organism that's not that simple.
Yeah.
In most cases, right? Some cases, yes. But as in the vast majority of cases, it's not as simple as fixing a broken part and getting better. So public wants that. They go see clinicians. Clinicians want to be able to offer that. They want to be able to offer, like, here's something I'm going to do to you to get you better,
mm-hmm.
to fix your problem. And so it's... What I would love to see was if all clinicians across the world, let's start in BC, where we live, but start here, would have a proper understanding of the, of what their interventions are doing or not doing, and would and could emphasize the use or emphasize that to the patients. So people would stop searching for a fix.
Yeah.
They'd stop looking for something to be done to them rather than being kind of what our friend Keith says, you know, be supported in their self-management. How can we be part of your team to help you get better? Mm-hmm. That is what I would love to see.
I have a philosophical discussion to have about that now.
Okay.
Is what, like, people are coming in with that idea that they want to be fixed because they believe they're broken. Or, you know, you can search for another term. But is that also because, let's just say in the last 50 years, those narratives that we as manual therapy practitioners have been preaching is telling them that they're broken, and we've put the idea in their head that they need to be fixed, as opposed to long before we were all doing this, like we've had discussions before about, like, what did grandma and grandpa do?
Yeah.
They, for lack of a term, they sucked it up and got on with it.
Yeah. Got on with your life.
And they got on with their life. And because, you know, back in those days, there wasn't a bunch of chiropractors, massage therapists, and physiotherapists kicking around to treat them. They just had some pain and they went, well, I still got to go milk the cows and I still got to put hay in the barn and I still got to do this other stuff. So really, have we caused this opinion that people have, or have our professions caused this thing?
I would say that is really deep.
Deep thoughts by Jack Handy.
Those who don't know, that's from like the 90s. I'm sorry about that. That's so good. I used to have a Jack Handy calendar.
Oh, it must have been amazing.
Oh, it was great. It was so good. I can't remember if it was a monthly calendar or a daily calendar. Was there 365 Jack Handy?
Probably.
It might have been a daily one. That's so good. I would say it would be a big statement to say we caused it, but I would definitely say that we haven't helped it. I would say we haven't helped.
We've been an influencer to it.
I say we, meaning the kind of the healthcare professionals.
Yeah.
You know, and we may have talked about this before, but in order to become kind of recognized as a legitimate healthcare profession, I know in BC, and probably in Ontario and other provinces as well, have been legislated for a while. In order for us as massage therapists to be like respected by the medical community, we had to take on
this extra stuff.
This like biomedicalism of what we do. And I think that has probably definitely not helped. Mm-hmm. Now it helped us become established as a legitimate healthcare profession. But I think now that the evidence is pushing, you know, us 30, 40 years towards this kind of biopsychosocial stuff. So it's not just this tissue-based thing, and it's more of a human-centered, a person-centered thing. That we've stayed in the past, and we haven't moved further enough forward.
Yeah.
And I believe that has contributed to more and more problems.
Yeah. Which is also interesting, because you talk to some people like massage therapists that have been around for a long time, and they're like, biopsychosocial, that's how we used to treat. Because we always talked about just treating the person in front of us and looking at their stress and other things like that. So
it's more holistic. I know the holistic term can be
triggering
to some people, but when we're looking holistic, you're looking at the whole person in front of you. We've had that before. We've taught courses and people have come in and like, we used to practice way, then we had to become very medicalized. I never really liked the medicalization of it. But we had to kind of bring that on. And now that you guys are talking about this stuff, it makes me think of the way things used to be with less of the woo, but more of a science to explain it. And that's really the way I think it should be.
I mean, those things were long before our time in this profession, where things were happening.
Long before. I feel like I've been practicing forever, but I guess not really.
Yeah.
16 years in practice.
When we teach some of those courses and people are like, I'm a massage therapist 30 years. I'm like, oh my goodness.
35, 40 years. That's amazing. That's great.
Yeah.
Good for you. That's longevity. Yeah.
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 So I think when we look at the overall picture of this, if you like treating people with tools, keep treating people with tools.
Yeah.
If you want to go take a course about how to use IASTM in your practice, go take the course. But just make sure when you're talking to people or talking to the patients that you treat, that you're using a better narrative than what they're teaching in the course, unless somebody has radically updated one of those courses, which hopefully is happening.
Yeah.
Then just use that better narrative. Yeah. And, you know, if people come in and they like you using a handlebar on them, then go ahead and use a handlebar on them.
As long as they know what's actually happening.
Yeah.
And that goes down to patient consent.
Yeah. We've talked about that a little bit before.
Yeah. Whereas, you know, patients do have a right to understand what it is you're doing and why you're doing it.
Yeah.
And because they're supposed to get your consent. I'm going to use this tool on you to make this area feel better and provide some stimulus here and hopefully desensitize it.
Yeah.
For example, that's kind of some of the type of thing, something similar that I would say.
Go ahead, write that down. Use it in your practice.
Yeah. versus I'm going to use this to break down the scar tissue or to like eliminate these trigger points because that's why you're in pain.
Yeah.
You know, there's difference, right? And I think the consent should be based on what we know is the least wrong idea. Yeah. And I would say, yeah, same as you. Like, I would say, go ahead and use tools. If you want to take a course on it, you can. Our bias is take one of our courses.
Yeah, of course.
where we will hopefully help you to understand the pain, the mechanisms behind it. Understand kind of some of the variables about the kind of biopsychosocialism of things.
How to get people moving.
We'll address some of the misconceptions within the profession. But also the key, is about like the movement. Like, what do you do after the massage?
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's the big.
How do you reinforce your massage? You
reinforce what you're doing. And so our bias is you can take these courses, but if you feel comfortable and confident in already all your different ways of touching people differently.
Yeah.
And touching them nicely.
Which we learned enough in term one and two in school.
Right. Then now let's try and how do we make what we do better?
Let's look at the bigger picture of how we can help people.
Yeah.
That sounds like a great way to end this episode.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Always look at the bigger picture of how you can help people. Change your narrative. Be good to your people.
Well said, my friend.
All right. We'll call it a wrap on that one. See ya. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. These kind of topics are what we are all about. If you'd like to learn more, go to our websites.
TheMTDC.com or EricPurvis.com. If you know of any other therapists that could benefit from this, please tell them to subscribe.